Hi, I'm Logan Medish, your host of the High Caliber History Podcast. And on this week's episode, we're talking all about the Vickers machine gun, its long and storied history, used during multiple wars, a remarkable reference collection of the guns with tons of great information, as well as some interesting myths and stories that have arisen around the gun, such as hip firing it while still attached to a tripod and making a cup of tea from the boiling water in the barrel jacket. All that and more on this episode. Hope you enjoy. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the High Caliber History Podcast. I'm your host, Logan Medish, and I am joined today by Rich Fisher. He is the director of the Vickers MG Collection and Research Association based in Wiltshire, England. He's also a research fellow at Cranfield University, working with the Defense Academy of the UK Ministry of Defense, and he's a trustee of the Small Arms School Corps Infantry Weapons Collection Trust. Wow, that's a mouthful. Which is the Army's reference collection for infantry weapons. So, Rich, welcome to the podcast.
Hi there.
How are you today?
Yeah. I'm good. Thank you.
Good, good. So, the Vickers MG Collection and Research Association. What is that?
Well, it's a not-for-profit organization that I set up 10 years ago now, so 2011, to sort of take over, if that makes sense, the running of my collection that I'd started 25 years ago now. So I've been collecting Vickers MGs since I was 12 years old. So I bought my first... Yeah, so it's deactivated Vickers at that point. Bought my first one, age 12, and since between then and 2011, I'd been expanding the collection, and I'd been, buying up what I could around the Vickers, making relationships, doing lots of research on the Vickers, and for a few reasons, I started to realise that the collection was now somewhat bigger than I'd ever intended. I don't know whether I'd intend as a collection, it was always intended to grow, but whether it was intended to get quite as sole focused as it was. I'd been collecting militaria for a few years before I've bought the Vickers, since I was 8 or 9, just bits and pieces, mainly family related. And I'd been buying other militaria and other small arms while I was buying the Vickers stuff as well. But I'd focused on the Vickers and meant that I had quite the collection at that point. And more and more people were interested in it and coming to see it. So I formed this not-for-profit body that would own it, and it protected it, actually. So it protected it from circumstances in my life, be that job redundancy or all these things that you sometimes go, well, I could sell a gun and it will pay for that. I gave all of that stuff into the collection so that I didn't get tempted to do that, because I sort of thought, well, it's a bit more important than that now. Sure. It's not just something for the future. It, for me, actually, it's quite a comprehensive set of Vickers machine guns. And I realized there were some benefits of becoming a not-for-profit association, a limited company as well.
Gotcha. So what leads a 12-year-old kid to go, you know what, I'm going to buy a Vickers machine gun?
my granddad. So my grandpa was a Vickers machine gunner in the Second World War. He served with the Cheshire Regiment, which were one of the regiments that converted to machine guns in the British Army. And he joined up in 1943. So he'd spent a few years as a home guard. Here and then when his younger brother was old enough to take over the farm, he was able to join the army, and he joined up and got sent to the Cheshire Regiment. He had some mechanical knowledge, but we don't know whether that was any reason why or just ended up in the SIFT for the Cheshires at that point. And so, as I said, I was sort of getting some militaria bits and pieces, and we went to the Royal Marines Museum in Portsmouth in 1994 for the 50th anniversary of D-Day, and he sat down behind a Vickers that was on display there and took it apart, and I was just sort of mesmerized at that point that As it turns out, that was 50 years since he'd probably had last, handling of a Vickers as well, because he transferred out of the Cheshires in June 1944, and he served in Italy. So he transferred out of the Cheshires, became an infantier, and probably didn't see the Vickers again. So, wow. 50 years, and he could remember how to do that was quite mesmerizing.
That's cool. Yeah, one of those things kind of like riding a bike, right?
Yeah, I think so. And it just happens that my other grandfather was into shooting, game shooting and things like that. So he had a copy of the magazine Gunmart, and all of the Australian made Vickers machine guns were for sale over here in the UK at the time. And he showed me it, and I happened to have enough money. It's £350. So I went and bought one.
Very cool.
Yeah, and it arrived like in the week of my 12th birthday.
How about that? That's really cool. So of course that particular gun you had already mentioned was a deactivated piece. But I know that there are a number of fully functioning Vickers guns in the collection. But of course you are over in the UK. So how does that work? I mean, I guess some of that probably has to do with the fact that you said you technically don't own the guns and stuff. But so explain how that works.
Yeah, so it was one of the reasons that I had the foresight to set up an association, set up this limited company. So I knew that as an individual in the UK here, holding what we call Section 5 weapons, probably some sort of Class 3 weapons in the US, but uh-huh. Section 5 authorization is few and far between and normally linked to business. So to have the Section 5 authority from the Home Office, so again, sort of that central government authorization, needed to have a business case behind it, and it needed to justify a few extra reasons as to why we can do that. So it's mostly authorizations for these in the UK are film and theatre and television companies that do the armourer hire into those things, because you've talked about, there's loads of sort of film guns and stuff, and a vast majority of those are filmed in the UK.
Sure.
So there's a lot of firing and live firing weapons over here. And a really interesting market dynamic in them, because there's a lot of supply but very little demand in most cases. So it's something that we looked at originally about 8 years ago. So the association is a few different directors and quite a few members now that can use this stuff, and we sat down a few years ago and said, okay, let's be serious about it and let's think, what is the benefit for us to hold firing or fully functioning rather than firing? Because there's a few different nuances about what we can do, and we said, well, what's the benefit of doing that? Well, it means we can explain the Vickers in a really different way to people than just having a static display. Or we can get under the skin of the nuances in the Vickers, and we can learn some of this stuff ourselves.
Okay.
So if we want to learn how much water it genuinely takes to boil the jacket and which bits break and all of these different things that you can't get from a deactivated gun. Now, the deactivated guns in the collection are still really valuable and actually have a higher value than the firing guns, because they're more eminently tradable on the market. We don't dip in and we don't sell stuff out of the association. It's safeguarded for that, but it does mean that it does have a significant value. But it means that those guns can go out and display. Those guns can be handled by other people. Mm-hmm. The Section 5 weapons can't, but it does mean that we can sit down, show somebody something on a deactivated gun. If they want to see a firing demonstration, we can do that on the live firing or the blank firing guns that we have here as well.
Okay, very cool. Now, the collection is not just guns. You've got a lot of equipment and other things that go with it. For those who are checking out the podcast, the video version on YouTube, they'll notice that there's a horse mannequin over your shoulder here.
Yes.
And before we started recording, you showed me around the shop, and there's a Jeep that's off camera as well. So it's more than just the guns. So what else is in the collection and why?
Yeah, let me just pick this up a minute then, and I'll just have a do the same thing again. So we've got the collection here, say in Wiltshire, and we do try to look at the guns, which are mainly over on this side, and they're the deactivated examples. But to give the whole sort of concept of the capability, what is machine gunnery? We've got some of the vehicles, bits and pieces, Jeep, and then the mannequin horse over my shoulder stood in front of a First World War limited. We've got sort of dugout and bits and pieces, and then down on the table is the remnants of the spare parts video that I did a few weeks ago. So it's all about being able to demonstrate machine gun capability and everything that goes with the Vickers machine gun, because okay. It is complex. People just quite often they'll go and visit it in a museum and it'll be a just a machine gun on a plinth, maybe with no accessories, nothing around it, and it's sort of sterile in that way. But sure. In reality, getting a machine gun into action requires X number of men. It requires so much more equipment and the logistics to be able to do so as well. So being able to understand that machine gunnery capability makes you realize how difficult actually a lot of machine gunnery isn't just about sitting behind the thing and pressing the thumb piece on the cross piece. Right. And it makes sure that it reaches back all the way from from the front line all the way back to home with the industrial supply and everything like that as well. So one of the things that I try and look at is all this multifaceted approach of understanding the Vickers from a practical research perspective. So that's why we go out and do the firing and the videos, and that's probably what people see and sort of stop at sometimes. But then the website's been in existence now since 97 98, so as a keen young sort of teenager on my first year of work experience, I got taught how to write HTML code for a website. So first thing I wanted to do about was write about the machine gun, and that's sort of the story of my life and my career. First thing I wanted to do is work out how I can blend it with machine guns. Put the website up there. Some people might go beyond the videos and beyond the social media and look at the website, and we've got some depth of research in there. And then some people might want to go, and me particularly, of saying what's the real scratch under the surface stuff. So as an academic, I write quite a lot of papers, and I'm always trying to link those into machine gunnery as well. So that sort of multifaceted approach of going from surface information, be it a few minutes on YouTube, through to, somebody's going to research this a bit more. And then if somebody wants to really understand the academic depth behind things, then we'll go into that as well. Or certainly try to, and I've been involved in a few book projects that take it sort of mainstream stuff as well.
Okay. Now, with the guns that are capable of being fired, you had touched on something that I thought was interesting, and it sparked something in a slightly different direction. You were talking about being able to see how much does it take to actually make the water boil in the jacket, and I know you have done some pieces on, trying to dispel some of the myths and the soldier stories that float around the gun. And one of the ones I want to touch on that I think is kind of interesting is the lore of guys making tea using the water in the jacket. I mean, technically, I guess you could get the water hot enough that you could do it. But have you run across anything that either speaks to the affirmative or the negative in whether or not that would have happened and why?
Yeah, so I have, and it's one of those that one day we will have a video of it and I will find somebody to drink some. because we're British and we make tea. So range tea must have a meaning. And there's a few accounts, and they seem to stem from a couple of First World War accounts that say they did it. Now, I don't know whether that is just old soldiers telling tales to try and get somebody caught up and drinking tea out of the water jacket. you certainly can. The bit that I stop, but so I think they possibly did. You've got some steaming water there. Maybe you're not making tea out of it, but maybe you're using it for shaving water or washing water and stuff like that. Okay. Because you've got to bear in mind that it wasn't until, I think it's 1917, 1918, that they really start saving the water as well. So before that point, it always goes into a canvas bag, not into a tin. So once it goes into a canvas bag, it's there. It's not to conserve the water. It's being done so the steam doesn't give away your gun position. It's not to save water. So it's not until really late on in the Great War that they start to conserve water in that way. So it's, I think they might have used the hot water for shaving, and they might have used the hot water for after a barrage and stuff like that. Whether they drank it, well, I think that would depend on how well that gun was cleaned, whether it was full of oil, whether there were bits in it, and how far those guys were behind the line. Because by that period of the war as well, you know, a Vickers machine gun isn't going to be seen in the front line. Probably even behind, maybe second line for defensive purposes, and then beyond the third line even for barrage fire and stuff like that. So in those circumstances, when you've got a lot of guns firing in barrage, there's going to be a lot of boiling water around. You know, why stick the kettle on? You don't need to. But yeah, we haven't tried it. I haven't tasted it. We will do one day, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I've never had tea from a Vickers, but you may be familiar. There are Sharps carbines from the Civil War that had coffee grinders built into the buttstocks.
Yes. Yeah.
There's only a handful of them, and I had the opportunity in a former professional position where we had the opportunity to grind some coffee beans and actually make some coffee from it, and I was the only one dumb enough to volunteer for that. It ground the beans. It worked. And the coffee wasn't that great, which I think that was more an issue with the beans. I can't really fault the grinder for that. But but it's one of those things that you don't really know. You're like, okay, guys say maybe we can do it, you know, until you actually put it into action and try to use it to grind the coffee beans or try to use it to make a cup of tea. You don't really know for sure just how viable something like that is. So that's very cool that you have active pieces in the collection that you can theoretically do things like that, that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise.
Nobody else is going to do that. With no disrespect to any of those other sort of collectors and people out there, is that we do sort of blend that bit of firing and research. So when we get a few challenges on Twitter and Facebook and places like that, and a couple that came from Twitter last year, one of these came from Twitter and one came from a visitor. So the first one was a guy called Longhurst, won a military medal in North Africa, an Australian, 6 foot something Australian, you know, really strong guy, got the military medal for, basically got really annoyed with the Italian tanks. And so he stands up on top of the parapet of the trench, picks up the Vickers machine gun and fires it from the hip. And people were like, how did he do that? What did he do? Because he didn't take it. There's no account of him taking it off the tripod or anything like that.
Oh, gosh.
So, we thought, well, let's try it. Only with blank ammunition. I don't think any range would let us do that. But, we tried it. And it gets loads of stoppages because the belt's flapping around and things like that. But as soon as you sort of work out, well, okay, if I just stay still and I don't move too much and I do this, you go, that's how it works. Nobody else was going to be doing that. If you want to watch the video, it's on YouTube and you can probably hear my spine click as I pick it all up. But then the other one that came up was an account of Monte Cassino in Italy in 1944, something called the Ghost Gun. And it was a case of what's that? And this, the chap that was talking to me about it was like, I should know. And I've never heard of it. And I've been to Monte Cassino a couple of times. I haven't heard of it. So let's just do a bit of research. And turns out it was a piece of wire that was wrapped around the cross piece of the Vickers in such a way that you could be in a safe position some distance off, pull the wire and it would fire the gun. So again, let's just try that. Let's do a bit of experimenting in the workshop, see how that works, and then take it down the field and do some firing to see if we can get that work. And the video's there, and it worked quite well, and it worked quite quickly. Again, it's ammunition feed. You know, it proves the point of why that number two or assistant gunner is really important, because all of the stoppages caused by doing something different to the gun are always about ammunition feed. So you start to do a few of these little practical experiments and you start to realize where the weakness of the guns actually exist as well, which is quite good.
That's cool. Now, if we're talking about hip firing one, whether it's attached to a tripod or not, let's talk about the weight of something like that. What does the gun weigh? What does the tripod weigh? What's it weigh with all the ammo? I mean, that's
okay.
A Vickers is not a portable machine gun in that instance, right?
No, it's not. So this is where I can talk Imperial as well, because you'll understand it. Whereas I have to convert things in my head to kilograms over here. So the gun with water in the barrel jacket is about 45 pounds. And then the tripod's about 50 pounds. So every box of ammunition is about 22 pounds as well. So if you're trying, you know, so suddenly you've got 115, 120 pounds to pick up. Now I did that experiment without water in the jacket, so you can take 10 pounds off that weight. But it certainly does. So the horse here in front of the limbered wagon, when that's got kit for two guns in it, that is 3,500 pounds. So with the 28 boxes of ammunition, so that's what goes in, you know, is sort of the first line equipment for the Vickers. That's 3,500 pounds. The if you take a fully loaded universal carrier, that's 4 tons with all the ammunition it was carrying for that, and only three guys at that point. So the mobility of the Vickers is something that becomes a problem, really. But in the Great War, we're talking about limbered wagons getting as far forward as they can, then take the guns out of the wagon, put it on pack saddlery on the animals, then they'll carry it forward as far as they can go, and then the guys themselves take it off. So there's 8 men in a detachment at that point, so 16 men for every two guns, clearly moving this stuff forward. But then we get into the Second World War and they're using universal carriers. So Bren gun carriers, small little open-topped armored vehicles on tracks. And the gun team reduces to 4 guys, and that includes the driver.
The
carrier. Because he can get so much further forward, you haven't got to have metalled roads. You haven't got to change things to animals. Literally, that carrier can get right up to the gun position, dump stuff off, and then go away again.
Wow.
So the mobility becomes really interesting to understand and study. But it's worth remembering, and I've mentioned it a couple of times recently, is that the infantry battalions of the British Army as we went into the Second World War were not mechanized. Although the British Army was the most mechanized army in the world at the time, with loads of universal carriers, 1,500 weight trucks, things like that. You know, we'd largely got rid of our horse-drawn transport, unlike most other countries. But within that, you had the divisional machine gun battalion, which was all of the Vickers machine guns consolidated together. So you had 48 Vickers working together in one unit, and they were all born on either truck or carrier. So machine gun carrier, slightly different variant, and it made it the most mechanized part of the infantry division at that point, which by terms makes it the most mechanized part of the British Army is the machine guns. And when you start to think about the weight of things and what they weigh and what they carry, you know, how far they carry these things, they don't carry them very far at all, because they don't need to get to the front line, because it's got the full, you know, range out to 4,500 yards. You don't need to get right up to the front. You can get to where the vehicles can take you. And so, you know, guys like my grandfather were generally not carrying the Vickers very far at all. Of course they were in training. Of course they were fit enough to do so. But once that Vickers was in position, be it on, you know, on the ridge at Monte Cassino and places like that, they'd have had to carry it up there. You know, there were no mules getting forward at that point. but once they'd got it in position, they were largely staying there as well. So it does, again, you know, it does make you think how these things work. Were they taking the guns in and out every time? No, they were just leaving them there. Quite often they do handovers with other units, and the guns would be signed over to the other units as well, so they wouldn't even exchange things when they were that close to the enemy. So it's it's not the sort of heavily laden soldier that you'd expect all of the time. You can't carry more than four boxes of ammunition. You know, four boxes is 100 pounds or 88 pounds. You know, that plus your personal kit is not an option. You might carry two. Though the guys that you have the real admiration for, actually, in terms of moving the Vickers around, were those in the Great War that were moving forward to consolidate positions. So they were walking across no man's land that had just been shelled, walking across German trenches that had been shelled, having to take the guns and all the kit across that muddy environment in many cases, you know, because never start an offensive in the dry. What's the point? Those guys were carrying this stuff across. They didn't have their limbered wagons. When you read about the huge machine gun barrages, they might have a whole company, or sometimes, you know, more than a company of infantry carrying ammunition for them.
Wow.
160 guys just like, here's two boxes of ammunition, take them to that position over there.
My goodness. Yeah,
just to support. So that whole logistics piece is absolutely huge.
Yeah. Oh, it's numbers that I hadn't imagined. And you don't really think about, like you said, the logistics are more important than the weaponry, because without the logistics of getting the stuff there, you're not going to be fighting with it. And I want to talk a little bit about the differences between the use of that gun in World War I and in World War II. You know, of course, we see a tremendous amount of change and advancement in technology and, you know, what is being used to wage war between those two conflicts. And yet the Vickers is a constant. You know, we see it in both conflicts. But what, you know, talk a little bit about what were the differences in how that gun was utilized in those two conflicts? Because as much as things stay the same, they're incredibly different. And to be able to utilize something like the Vickers in two completely different types of war, I think that speaks to the versatility of the gun. So what can you tell us about the difference between the two conflicts with the Vickers?
So it's not just a conflict. It just gives me an opportunity to say, yeah, British Army had that in service from 1912 to 1968. So I've got a catalogue on the shelf behind me that is the 1964 like British Army equipment and weapons. And in it, you've got the Vickers two pages away from tactical nuclear weapons. So it does make you go, oh, whoa, okay. It was really hanging around. It wouldn't go away. And that's despite the British Army trying to get replacements for it. So it's worth remembering that, you know, it was the machine gun that they had. It doesn't necessarily mean it was the machine gun that they wanted. So by the Second World War, in the late 1930s, we'd obviously replaced the Lewis with the Bren gun. And we were trying to replace the Vickers at the same time. Also with something from Bruno, and we were really keen on the Beezer machine gun at that point to be used as a medium machine gun. So we were trying to get rid of it, actually, or trying to find a suitable alternative, but nothing could be found as a suitable alternative because it didn't have the staying power of a water-cooled machine gun. Sure. So it isn't until the general purpose machine gun, the FN Mag, L7, M240, whatever it ends up being called, it isn't until that comes in the late 50s, early 60s that we find a suitable replacement. So the Vickers in the Second World War is really about providing concentrated firepower in an infantry division. So we've consolidated all the machine guns into this divisional machine gun battalion, which is very similar to what we did in the First World War with the formation of the Machine Gun Corps. So the Machine Gun Corps is formed to bring together command, control, logistics, all of these elements, and training, actually, as well. So one of the, you know, disbenefits of having a medium machine gun that's different, it's not a universal or a general purpose machine gun, is that you need to train guys completely differently. You cannot train somebody on a Bren and go, oh, here's a Vickers, it's a machine gun. Surely you know how to use it. You don't. You know, even today, you know, one of the first things that you notice is you need to crank the Vickers twice. You know, what other guns do you need to crank the Vickers twice on if you're sort of moving up that way? So you need to keep training separate. But we have this mechanized this sort of hugely mechanized divisional machine gun battalion in the Second World War. And it means that you can use it in defensive and withdrawal situations a lot easier, because you can leave the guns in place for a lot longer move them as you need to. The main change that enables some of that to be done is this, and I mentioned 4,500 yards as being the range for the Vickers. And that only comes in 1937-38. So although we were looking for a new machine gun, we were also playing about with the ammunition for the Vickers. So the 303 inch ammunition now, at this point, is Mark 8Z, which takes that range from 2,700 to 4,500. Wow. So you've not only got this immensely mechanized unit that you can move where you need it, but it has a much longer reach as well. So it has the same reach as your mortars. Okay. And that shows it being used with and alongside mortars. So not only were infantry battalions, infantry battalions had their own mortar capability, 3-inch mortar, 81 mil, but the divisional machine gun battalions also had 4.2-inch mortars. So the British Army's never had 120 mil mortar, but 4.2-inch is about 105, 106 mil. So, it has a company of those, so 12 of those, and then 36 Vickers machine guns, being able to provide that sort of divisional firepower alongside the artillery. But you've got to bear in mind that the artillery, although mobile, isn't necessarily mechanized and more mobile in the same way. And what you find with the machine gun events, actions that are taking place, is that they're really just using those in indirect fire. So indirect fire in this case, I got myself into trouble recently because I was talking about direct and indirect fire with an artilleryman, and he was just like, well, is flat or high? No. Direct is targets you can see, indirect is targets you can't, that are obscured. So they're mainly using it in indirect fire with the Mark 8Z ammunition, barrages makes you think it's going to be an extended period of time and stuff like that. But map predictive fire. So they're using it to, crossroads, harassing fire, break up advances, break up concentrations of troops. And the benefit of machine gun fire, small arms machine gun fire on the battlefield, is you can't tell where it's coming from. And in most cases, you can't tell where it's landing either. So there's no observation of machine gun fire at this point. They're using it very much in a harassing kind of role for advances, say to break up concentrations, and then those universal carriers are whipping in, picking up the guns, moving them to a different position that's already been identified on the maps, doing some more harassing fire into a different place, picking them up again, moving them forward with the advancing companies and battalions so that they're right there to consolidate positions quickly. Now that is very similar to what was being done in the last 100 days of the Great War and in the last couple of years. But before that, really, because of those mobility issues and logistics issues, what you would have is machine guns forming a barrage to break up to work alongside the artillery in the barrages that they were having. So really close in stuff. They'd have to move forward as the advance moves forward, or theoretically, not many advances went beyond the range of machine gun fire in the first day. So they'd have to move forward, and that would take some time. So the logistics and the mobility would obviously be affected. But in the Second World War, actually, it means that you can move forward something with a greater reach from the infantry division quicker than you can move forward the infantry itself in some cases. So it's being used almost as a mobile, I say mobile, but as a very sort of quick reaction force kind of idea, to move it to where it needs to be, because you've got from a manpower to firepower ratio, it's really high in the machine gun battalions.
Gotcha. Now the association itself, I mean, obviously in some sense, I mean, it's your collection, but it's the association's collection. And of course, the goal of all this is education. And because it's more than just a personal collection, there is an outreach component. And I know you guys do displays and demonstrations But the collection itself is actually something that is accessible to researchers as well. So talk to me a little bit about the association's goals and what it hopes to do in terms of moving forward the public education with the Vickers, and what your plans are for the future for the association, because I know there's some anniversary dates coming up quickly for you guys as well.
Yeah, that's right. So we you know, the collection here, you know, it is my collection, but it isn't, you know, it's sort of my custody of it now. Right. It's not something I've got direct control of in terms of going, if I'm not interested in this anymore, you know, for some reason, this is still going to be somewhere as a single collection. And you know, there's a sort of board of directors and a series of members that help, you know, steer and control and do that. And that's a really wide range of membership as well, because if you were to ask an audience who's interested in the Vickers machine gun, the demographic of the membership that we have would not match that in any way. So
really?
You know, we have, we've got a retired Army general with a Machine Gun Corps Victoria Cross Gallantry Award in the family, that I work with regularly. He's one of the members. We've got film and TV companies, some representatives of those that are members. But then we've got guys all the way down to sort of reenactors and living historians, guys that probably come in and get their hands dirty a bit more as well. But then we've got researchers, academics that just are interested enough to go, actually, there is a lot more to be learned about this. How can we do it? We've then got family, relatives, partners, people that just want to understand and observe or what their relative did. And even to some extent, we've got relatives of people that have been involved in the association as well. So it's a really mixed demographic, and that's great in terms of the discussion, because they all bring something different to that. So we try and react off some of that. And the main sort of culminating points over the next 5 years for us are largely all falling next year in 2022. So 1922 was the year of the disbandment of the Machine Gun Corps. So I've mentioned it, First World War, British Army formed Machine Gun Corps in 1915. It only lasted for 7 years. There was a sort of a bun fight in the early 20s about army expenditure, who was going to get the money, and they couldn't afford to continue this corps. So they disbanded it, and all the Vickers machine guns went back to infantry battalions, and infantry regiments. So the corps itself at one point was bigger than the British Army is today. In terms of, there's about 120,000 men at the maximum period in the machine gun corps. So it had this huge footprint, and it lasted for such a short period. And, 100 years on, we want to make sure that that is commemorated fully and take the opportunity to turn around and say, well, look, this is what was learned from the machine gun corps. Mm-hmm. And this is what machine gunnery benefited from, having a core of expertise in that way, because as soon as you send that out to the infantry and cavalry regiments as well, to say, well, you have your own machine gun company, what you're relying on is your training establishments to send out the right message of this is how you use machine guns. And if you're reliant on that, you're then reliant on people coming back to those training establishments for retraining. Right. Whereas if you just have a core, which has this sort of, ongoing conversation about how we get the best out of machine guns, in my view, it generates more ideas, it generates more innovation, it generates more sort of expertise naturally and organically, rather than reliant upon a reach back into an organization. So they disband it, but there's incredible lessons that were learned from that. And the 100th anniversary of that disbandment is next year. And we're trying to put together some stuff, to commemorate that, and to commemorate, machine gunnery as an art and a science, in putting that all together. Sure. And then also at the end of 2022 is the 110th anniversary then of the Vickers being adopted. So it was adopted in November 1912, and it just happens to be, you know, 10 years from then was when the Machine Gun Corps disbanded, and sort of everybody thinks machine guns are done, but they'll certainly hang around for a long period. So we'll try towards the back end of next year, we're going to try and make sure that we remind people of you know, how machine gunnery, how the Vickers machine gun particularly had that influence. So yeah, really interesting times ahead. You know, hopefully we'll get, you know, depending on what the world situation is at the time, and museums and stuff like that, we'll get some of this stuff out to, we'll loan some of these out to on possibly a roving collection, a roving sort of short-term display out to some of the museums that don't have this stuff. Try and get something centrally, maybe probably in London, to try and you know, get a central display that talks more about the Machine Gun Corps. Try and gather in some of those gallantry awards and get them together. So the Victoria Crosses that exist, there were 7 awarded to the Machine Gun Corps, and we know the locations of most of those. So we'll try and get those. We can tell those stories in full as well. And just say, try and do more to educate and inform about the Vickers. You know, people didn't realize they needed to be educated, informed about the Vickers, but I suppose that's the first bridge to get across, is making people realize they want to know more.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. That's fascinating that the Corps is only in existence for 10 years, but you figure, you know, that the gun is in use still, you know, from 22 when it, you know, when the Corps disappears to 68. I mean, that's a huge span of time to have not had the Corps there, and that to bump it back the even 10 years further, the 1912 to 1968. I mean, it's amazing the amount of change in technology that we witness, and yet the Vickers is still, you know, chugging along, doing its thing, relatively unchanged. You know, you figure 1912, we are at that point, we're just shy of a decade from the Wright brothers having taken their first flight, to 1968 when the gun goes out, and we've sent men into space at that point.
Yep. And here, off the moon landing, yeah.
Yeah, a year from the moon landing, and here's the Vickers still chugging along, doing its thing. It's amazing to think that the gun had such an impressive longevity and such staying power through that entire time period. Is really impressive, because there aren't many guns through the course of any country's history that last for that period of time. I mean, there's a few. You know, the U.S. had the 1911 that was in service for 74 yep. years, but it's not normal to see something like that.
No, I mean, the 50 cal Browning. The general purpose machine gun, the M240, is coming up to, you know, it's probably exceeded that now. I'd have to do the maths, but you know, it is interesting, because they don't, you know, there's only a few things that leap industrial ages, mm-hmm. and it's sort of a constant, and yeah, you know, the Vickers and some machine guns and some right. small arms do that. So when people, you know, so my day job, as I said, is working with the UK MOD, and some of that is around procurement and acquisition. And so when people bleat about, well, it's old, it's like, well, it still does the job. Yeah, you know, right. It's one of the ways I'm able to get the Vickers into what I talk about on a day-to-day business. But you go,
there you go.
Machine guns and small arms and things like that are one of those constants that you don't expect, like, short lifespans at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll have the same life. An aircraft carrier will likely have a shorter lifespan than an assault rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of go, well, that doesn't compute. and sometimes it doesn't, but it just is. You know, right. it's one of those things.
That's cool. Now, if this is something I ask everyone in the podcast, and you and I have talked about this a little bit before, and for those who have listened to other episodes, they know that that what I'm about to ask, the individual that there's an individual that comes up quite frequently. So I'm going to ask you, what gun designer, living or dead, would you want to meet, and why? And this is one of those instances where I know for a fact that you're not going to say the most common answer, which is Patrick Ferguson, which has come up. Yeah, there would be no reason for you to mention Ferguson. But for those who are aware of how the Vickers came to be, there is an individual whose name they're probably expecting you to say. But I have a feeling you're probably not going to say this individual. So without further buildup, What gun designer, living or dead, would you like to meet and why?
Dawson.
See?
A chap called Commander Dawson, Trevor, which is a great gun designer's name because it's so boring. now, this chap appears on so, and this is where you've got to scratch under the surface of things, because everybody would expect me to say Maxim.
Exactly. Yep.
And let's say Ferguson is the right answer. It clearly seems to be. From the
which I never would have expected it to have gone that way, really, but that does seem to be the common theme.
Because one of the other things, just to, you know, and I haven't mentioned it at all, but you got the name out right. Small Arms School Corps Infantry Weapons Collection Trust is the Army's reference collection down in Warminster, and some of the listeners will have visited that or certainly seen it in some of the videos online. So, but we have a Ferguson rifle down there, and I'm probably the most naive trustee of the board that when I first saw that, I was like, well, that looks interesting. What's that? And it had to be explained to me. So it probably means you won't air this now, because I didn't know who Ferguson was until about 8 months ago. But no, the chap that interests me is Dawson, because he's the guy that it seems he's the engineer that's responsible for turning the Maxim into the Vickers. And so he's the guy that came up with, well, if we turn this round and then we make this lighter and we put this different type of steel here, and we don't need to, you know, we can do loads of other stuff, but that'll do, surely. The British government will buy that. and that's what happens. So the 1908 light pattern Maxim, all the patents for that are written in this guy Dawson's name first. Maxim's out of the window. The questions that I'd really love to know is how much involvement Maxim had, because he was still around for another, you know, 8 years. He doesn't die until July 1916. So, yeah, he sort of, from what I understand, he was paid off and kept out of the way, because I can imagine he must have been really cantankerous about, you know, invention. You probably could, if it wasn't Maxim's idea, it was the wrong idea, is how that sort of comes across at that period of his life. And Dawson, and there's another couple of people as well, but Dawson's name is the one that comes up most frequently. And it's that real detail of who was he. Ex-Royal Navy, so, you know, clearly a clever chap, engineer, that I'd love to know more about him, and it's probably one of those research avenues that is going to be incredibly difficult to go down, because he's just such a no-name chap that appears on a patent.
Right. Wow. So you said his name comes up fairly frequently. So what other patents are do we see him on, anything that would be a little more familiar?
No. So it's what's coming out of Vickers at the time. So that's sort of mid-1900s period. So it's on some naval stuff. So you know, big ships. I think he must have been chief engineer at Erith Works at the time. So you see it on some like pom-pom guns, some of the changes around those in that period. But no, it's they came up with loads and loads of different ideas, and one of the reasons that, from what I can work out, one of the reasons that some of the developments on machine guns don't happen in other countries and they don't move to a Vickers type lightened version of the Maxim is because Vickers have patented it, so they can't. You know, they've got to buy the Class C Vickers machine gun from Vickers to get those benefits. And so many countries do. But it seems to stop the likes of the, you know, it means the Russian M1910 looks like it does. It means that the 1908, you know, the MG08 doesn't change too much, because you can't do that much with it, because Vickers have got you nailed on intellectual property law. Now, that's just a theory. It's not one I've exploited, but it's certainly a theory that seems to work, is that Vickers get the best or the lightest and most appropriate machine gun of its day. And that stays in the UK because we've patented it. And so much, you know, industrial development comes down to who patented things first.
Yeah.
You
know,
Maxim's own career is sort of born of patent failures in a way. You know, light bulbs come to mind. You know, oh, look, Edison, you know, he knew how to fill in the paperwork properly. So it's interesting to see what that potentially limited as armaments development around the world, as much as it promoted as well.
Mm-hmm. That's cool, and I'm glad. I mean, you know, it would be very cool to sit down with Maxim, you know, obviously. Yeah. But I love that you went more obscure, and you know, and I think it would be really cool, you know, to sit down with the two of them, and maybe see how they try to hash things out between the two of them, and who might want to try to take credit for this or that, or, you know, what internal squabbles there may have been between the two of them. I think that would be a really fascinating back and forth between those two guys, right? You know, it'd be neat to be a fly on the wall for that.
Yeah, I'd hope so. If it isn't, it's just one of those names that is written on my notebook of going, at some point I need to find out more about this bloke Dawson.
Right.
And, you know, no matter, you sort of only ever see snippets of information about him. And you know, maybe it warrants, some depth in the future, but there's just too many things on the list.
Yeah. Well, you know, who knows? Maybe someone who has tuned into this will go, you know what? I've got some spare time, and maybe they'll start digging, you know, you never know. So, well, Rich, I really appreciate you taking some time out of your day to come on the show. For people who are interested in finding out more about the Vickers MG Collection and Research Association, there will be links to the website that'll be able to take you to all the different social media and all the videos and everything. And you can join up and become a supporter of the association if you're interested in that. So that'll all be in the show notes, readily accessible to everyone. Rich, any final thoughts before we sign off?
No, not really. Just thank you very much for having me on. I mean, we're not exactly difficult to find. If you put Vickers machine gun, I think we predate Google's algorithm. We might even predate Google. So it's one of those where if you want to find out more about machine gunnery in general, actually, not just the Vickers, I feel dirty in doing so sometimes, but I talk about other machine guns as well.
Worry.
We're not difficult to find.
We won't tell the Vickers that you're seeing other machine guns. It's your secret's safe with us.
There's a couple of Brens in the cabinet that I have to keep in different cabinets so they don't know they're there.
Oh goodness. To wives and sweethearts, may they never meet, right? Awesome. Well, again, Rich Fisher, thank you so much for taking some time to be on the show. Perhaps we'll chat with you again sometime. But again, if anyone's interested, it'll all be in the show notes. Rich, thanks so much and have a good day, my friend. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the High Caliber History Podcast. Really hope you enjoyed it. Please feel free to share this with someone you think who also might enjoy it and leave us a rating and review on your favorite platform. Thanks for watching, thanks for listening, and we'll see you right back here next week with another great episode.